I am Tom Koppel. I'm an author and journalist in British Columbia on Salt Spring Island, and I am the author of Kanaka, The Untold Story of Hawaiian Pioneers in British Columbia and the Pacific Northwest. The book was published in 1995, although actually it took me quite a few years to write it off and on, working on it. It was a labor of love, something I was very interested in, the topic, and it was my first book. I've written a couple of books since then on other subjects, but it was the first popular book on the subject of Hawaiians in the fur trade and on the Northwest coast.
So how did you become interested in the subject?
Right.
And what information was out there already for you to look at?
Mm-hmm. I became interested because where I live, Salt Spring Island, had one of the largest groupings of Hawaiians outside the Hawaiian Islands that has ever existed anywhere. And in fact, it had descendants of the Hawaiians who worked in the fur trade. Dozens of them settled on Salt Spring Island. So it was one of the few places where there was actually a concentration of Hawaiians after the fur trade period. And these Hawaiians tended to live near each other. They intermarried with each other. And so on Salt Spring, as in very few other places, they kept up some of their traditions, awareness of their heritage. A lot of these people have gone back to Hawaii. They've traced relatives. They're very proud of their Hawaiian heritage. And so when I moved to Salt Spring 30 years ago, I began to hear stories about the local Hawaiians. Somebody pointed out an oldish man to me who's dead now, but a gray-haired man working on the ferry, the local ferry boat to the island, and said, "See that guy? He's part Hawaiian." And, you know, I looked and I could see it. Yes, he really did look it. He had these traits. And it was a very strong bloodline. And there was another person on the island, a woman, who ran a restaurant called the Kanaka Place Restaurant. And that was one of the first times I'd heard the term Kanaka. And on her menu, she had a short history of the Kanaka community because she was from a different Hawaiian family and was also very aware of it and had been to Hawaii and all of this. So there I was, learning about these things, aware of this. And meanwhile, I got into journalism and I began to write for magazines. And so one of the obvious subjects to me was the story of the Hawaiians of our area in British Columbia. And so then when I went to the public archives in Victoria, the British Columbia Archives, and started digging in, I realized that there was wonderful material, much more than just one magazine article's worth. And I realized also that nobody had ever done it. So that's how I set myself to task. Yeah.
And so if I could ask you some basic history questions
right
now.
Sure.
You're going to look at my questions.
Right.
No,
I can't see without my glasses.
So what changed? Could you tell me what changed in Hawaii when Captain Cook arrived?
To lead to the movement
of Hawaiians out of the islands.
Okay. Hawaii, I point out in my book, I'll start over. Don't want to keep saying the book. Hawaii was one of the most isolated major societies in the entire world. It was one of the last places on Earth that was actually discovered by Western mariners and explorers. To put this into perspective, before Captain Cook came to Hawaii, the Russians were already in Alaska. Captain Cook on an earlier voyage had already discovered Antarctica. The Spanish had been in Mexico for hundreds of years, and yet there was Hawaii sitting out in the middle of the North Pacific. Magellan had gone around the world a couple of hundred years before Captain Cook. So there was this very isolated, large society. I think the population was something like 300,000 people, which is a lot at that time, an Aboriginal population. And suddenly Captain Cook came and Hawaii was opened to whaling and missionaries and trade, and their culture, it was such a shock they must have not, they wouldn't have been totally unaware that there were any other people in the world, really. I mean, they had kept up some very tenuous links to the Marquesas and Tahiti and places like that. But basically, they didn't know that there were any other people anywhere. And suddenly, they were essentially deluged with white European and American missionaries, soldiers of fortune, people trading for sandalwood and things like that. And then the fur trade began, and ships were stopping in large numbers, taking on Hawaiians as crew members. And Hawaiians were curious about the world. And there seems to have been a great willingness on their part to go out and see, where did these people come from? What kinds of societies did they come from? They were interested, but at the same time, their own society was changing quite rapidly. Their kings were taking on Western ways. They were bringing in people like, as I mentioned, these soldiers of fortune to show them how to use weapons. In fact, that's how Kamehameha, the first king, unified the islands. It was with the advantage of Western weapons. Even just a few swivel guns on canoes was a dominant enough force to overwhelm his opposition. And so society was changing very quickly in the early 19th century. And their people were being driven off their ancestral land. Now, I don't want to make Hawaii sound as if it was some kind of paradise. I don't actually believe that it was. It was a repressive society in many ways. But people's whole lives were being thrown into upheaval. And at the same time, opportunities were opening up to them to go abroad, mainly as crew members on ships, such as on whaling ships. And then this new thing came along, the fur trade. And so sea otter furs had been discovered by Cook's first voyage to the northwest coast. The Russians already were involved with sea otter furs, trading with the Indians and selling the furs to China, where they commanded a tremendous price, sometimes up to $100 a fur. And this is in the beginning of the 19th century, when $100 was a fortune. The average working person didn't make $100 a year, and each sea otter fur was worth $100. So it was like black gold, the fur, the pelts. And so these ships began to arrive, and some of them took on Hawaiians just as observers or as passengers or as even as possible concubines in the case of certain women. And so there were a few Hawaiians who came to the northwest coast in the first few years of the 19th century just as passengers on these ships. But the organized fur trade really began with John Jacob Astor, the German-American tycoon, whose name is, of course, associated with the Waldorf Astoria. And Astor set up a company. He already had a fur trading company in the East, the American Fur Company, and he set up a new one, the Pacific Fur Company. And he decided to send a ship around Cape Horn and establish a fur trading post, a permanent fur trading post, at the mouth of the Columbia River, at a place that's now called Astoria in Oregon. And until then, there had been ships trading with the Indians along the coast, but it was kind of haphazard, and the Indians wouldn't know when the ships were going to arrive, and this kind of thing. So a fur trading post, a permanent establishment, a little fort, would be a totally new thing, and it was. So Astor sent his ship around the Horn, and on the way, they stopped in Hawaii, and at that time, most ships, sailing ships, had to really stop in Hawaii if they were going around the Horn or coming from Asia, either direction, because of the winds and the prevailing currents. It was very hard to sail a ship to the northwest coast without coming pretty close to Hawaii, and why would you not stop there at that time? Because they needed fresh water, they needed food usually. This is still a time when people would be dying of scurvy from lack of fresh food on board. So almost every ship automatically stopped at Hawaii. So Astor's ship stopped in Hawaii, and They had lost some of their crew, some absconded in Hawaii. This was very common. And so they needed, and actually they were slightly understaffed when they left. So they needed extra people. And they made a deal with the king and said, you know, we'll sort of a kickback. You know, the king got a little bit of extra money for each person, and the Hawaiians who were hired also got paid. So they hired 24 Hawaiians on this first ship to go and help build the fort in Astoria and also to work on the ship. So that's actually the first formal organized fur trading venture with the Hawaiians to the Northwest coast. And in the next few years, other ships came with more Hawaiians. And then this post of Astoria was taken over by the British as a result of the War of 1812. Actually, the British sent an overland party to capture it, but then the Astorians, the Americans working for Astor, they were not soldiers. They weren't going to die fighting the Brits, so they sold out. They sold the fort to the Brits. And that's how it was that first the Northwest Company and then the Hudson's Bay Company, both of these were British fur trading companies, that's how they acquired their foothold in what was then called the Columbia District.
Great. You went through a few of my questions there.
Okay.
That's wonderful. How did Hawaii and Hawaiian, the royalty or who was still in charge, how did they react to Hawaiians leaving? Just a second, let me move my hand.
Okay, go ahead. The government of Hawaii, as the fur trade developed, the government of Hawaii had contradictory feelings about it. On the one hand, they were earning some money from it themselves. They were selling licenses, in a sense. But on the other hand, as the 19th century moved along, they began to be concerned that too many young Hawaiian men in their prime years were actually leaving. Now, the fur trade was only part of it. More were leaving on whaling ships, and this was a very dangerous way of life. A lot of them never returned. Ships were shipwrecked, and there were lots of reasons why men might not come back. And some of them actually ended up just settling in other parts of the world. There were Hawaiians who served in the Mexican Navy, if you believe it. It sounds crazy, but they were. And there were Hawaiians in Peru, and there were Hawaiians who ended up in New England working on ships and then settling there. So Hawaiians were being spread around the world, and so the government actually in the 1840s tried to put limits on the number. They had kind of a quota system. They charged fines to captains who would recruit Hawaiians without permits. And in a way it was a tax. In other ways it was a sincere effort to try to reduce this outflow, because I believe it was something amazing, like 18% of all young men in their prime years had left Hawaii by the mid-1840s. So it was a very large outflux of young men. And at that time, the native Hawaiian population was declining from disease and other things like that. And so it was a sort of a double whammy, and they tried to limit it. And the fur trade altogether, the Northwest Coast fur trade, I believe something like 500 to 700 men went into the fur trade, but a couple of thousand at least went into whaling. So whaling was even bigger.
Mm-hmm. So of those that did go into the fur trade, because we are sort of focusing on that,
okay.
What were they employed to do?
When the Hawaiians signed up, they were almost without exception signing on as general laborers to do the lowest grade of work. They were not officers. Most of the officers were Scots or other Brits, a lot of them from the Outer Hebrides and the Shetland Islands and those places. But the Hawaiians went in as basic, they called them servants, low-end island workers, and their work was dependent on where they ended up, and they were assigned. It was like a military service. They had to take orders. They were assigned wherever the company wanted them to go. So some of them worked on ships. Now, they were very well seen as seamen and as mariners. They were good around boats, of course, and they knew how to swim at a time when lots of Europeans didn't know how to swim, lots of sailors even. And so they knew their way around boats. They could land boats on beaches in surf.
Wait a second. That was really great, what you were saying, but I'm hearing a clicking.
Uh-oh.
It's not the clock.
It is.
No, it's not. The clock's not bothering me. There's something. There's a... Sorry.
It was the clock, right?
No, I don't... Let me see if I hear it.
Now, sometimes when the heat comes on, should I turn off the heat? Maybe that way
we'll still be warm enough in here.
Would it be that? It sometimes makes a sort of expansion contraction.
I don't know. I just heard a click. I haven't heard it again, though, so...
I'll put it off.
Okay.
Yeah, we won't be cold if it's warm. Okay. One of the reasons that the Hawaiians were considered such good employees by the fur traders was that they knew their way around boats. They could land boats in the surf on beaches. They were strong swimmers at a time when so many Europeans couldn't swim at all, including lots of sailors. And so this was one of the big things that was in their favor. So many of them got assigned to work on boats on the rivers and the coastal waters of the northwest coast, and also some of them worked on the ships that went up and down the coast, larger ships. And for example, there was a steamboat, the Beaver, the first steamboat on the northwest coast, and a number of Hawaiians worked on the Beaver, shoveling coal into the boilers and things like that. So they were very good for that. But a lot of them ended up just doing any other job that needed doing, such as running sawmills. The Hudson's Bay Company soon got involved in cutting timber and selling it to places like Hawaii and San Francisco, which was a growing city. Honolulu was a growing city. They needed lots of good lumber, and there were these beautiful Douglas fir trees on the Columbia. And so they immediately started setting up sawmills. So quite a few Hawaiians worked at the sawmills. Others were sent inland, up the rivers to the interior posts. And so they would be working on the canoes, paddling the canoes, and carrying the backpacks of furs, sometimes over the portages and even over the mountains. So they were grunt workers doing all of these kinds of jobs. And then around Fort Vancouver, especially around Fort Vancouver on the Columbia and later around Fort Langley, they also became agricultural workers because the Hudson's Bay Company had to feed itself and the people on its ships, and they also made deals with the Russians in Alaska, where there was hardly any good soil or good climate for growing food. They sold food to the Russians in Alaska. So around Fort Vancouver, you ended up having thousands of acres of farmland with hundreds of heads of cattle and huge agricultural establishment, and lots of the Hawaiians ended up doing agricultural work.
You were talking about Astoria and how it was first American and then British. Mm-hmm. How did the American Revolution change anything with regard to that? Or was that sort of not as pertinent because it was all the way over?
This was way after the American Revolution. There was a war of 1812.
But did the, you know, the relations between British and America, situation,
okay.
Fighting over land, did that really matter as much because it was West Coast, or how did that affect
right.
the employees?
Okay. The conflict on the North...
Just start that again.
Okay. The conflict between the United States and Britain on the Northwest Coast was constantly simmering during the main period when the Hawaiians were working for the Hudson's Bay Company. Technically, the two countries were sharing. They had joint custody, joint ownership, of the Columbia country, but the British really had the foothold at first. However, as time went by, the Americans began to encroach. American settlers began coming over the Oregon Trail, for example. Still, until the gold rush in California, which started in 1848, the British were still dominant on the northwest coast. But the pressure was on. The election of, let's see, when was it, 1846 perhaps, or 44, there was an election fought on the slogan 54-40 or fight, and that was an American slogan claiming the entire Northwest right up to Alaska. So it was obvious to the Hudson's Bay Company fairly early on that they would probably be pushed out of at least the southern part of the Northwest coast, that somewhere a new line would be drawn, perhaps along the Columbia River, perhaps farther north. It ended up being farther north. But meanwhile, though, it's what's interesting for the Hawaiian story is that the Hawaiians, working for this British company, were seen increasingly as a loyal group who tended to favor the British. And Hawaii had a monarchy of its own, by the way, which is not uninteresting. And in the Hawaiian flag, there is the Union Jack. So Hawaii actually had a special relationship with Britain. And Hawaiian kings had gone and visited Britain. So there was a bit of a special relationship between the Hawaiian laborers and the British. And this worked to their favor later on in Canada, very much so.
One thing that I found interesting, and that also was brought up to me by a Native Hawaiian, was that a part in your book that's talking about something that happened, I guess, on the Tonquin, someone was drowned, and a Hawaiian was drowned, saving someone else.
Right early, coming across the Columbia Bar?
Yeah, before the Tonquin was blown up.
So, talk about that.
Yeah, because you found it interesting because that there isn't a record. It's one of the only records of Hawaiian burial ceremony, he said, was like the record that you found for your book. Mm-hmm. And thought maybe if you could sort of describe what happened.
Oh, I've forgotten exactly the details.
Sorry, I thought it was so cool.
I know, it was something like putting pork under their armpits or something.
Well, maybe just the idea. Is there a reason why some of these things, at least, you know, from his perspective, he said some of these things they don't talk about as much in Hawaii anymore, but you might find it still in the writings of people who are the white settlers from the area.
I don't know how I can put that together in a good way. I'm not sure.
If you don't remember the situation.
Well, I have just a quote from someone, but I can't really reconstruct it unless I were to read it. You want me to read it?
Yeah. Could you read that? Okay. I like that section.
When the first ship of John Jacob Astor's was approaching the Columbia River, there was a very nasty sandbar at the mouth of the Columbia, and they sent in some small boats, some of them with Hawaiian crew, some with white guys from the ship, and they went across the bar, and it was tremendously rough waves, and one or both of these boats flipped over. Some of the sailors, the white sailors, couldn't swim, and the Hawaiians were, a couple of them saved their lives. And in doing so, though, one of them actually eventually was in the water too long, and he perished. This is cold, much colder water than in Hawaii. And this was probably the first traditional Hawaiian burial that ever took place on the Northwest coast, and I'll just read briefly. The boat made it to shore eventually, but not before one of the Kanakas died. The dead man was buried by six Kanaka comrades according to their tribal customs. Each, before leaving the ship, had taken an offering of biscuit, pork, or tobacco. They put the biscuit under the arm of the deceased, the pork under the chin, and the tobacco under the testicles or genital organs. Then they put the body in the grave, and after covering it with sand and gravel, they formed a double line with their faces turned eastwards. One, officiating as a priest, went to fetch water in his hat, and having sprinkled the two rows of islanders, began a prayer to which the others responded. Then they rose and departed, and made their way back towards the ship without looking back. This unnamed Kanaka was the first, but far from the last, to lose his life in the treacherous coastal waters of the Pacific Northwest.
So I was going to ask you about the relations among the Europeans, the Hawaiians, mm-hmm. and then the people who are already here. Mm-hmm. But first, I know that I thought maybe you might want to just explain what First Nations is mm-hmm. and how
in
it's
Canada
similar
or just
to Native Americans. Just because I think other people I will interview will probably say First Nations when they're talking about it, and I thought it'd be good to have you sort of tell us what that means.
Right. In Canada, we usually use the term First Nations for Native Americans, although you sometimes hear Native Canadians also, or just Native, or still Indian. Lots of people still use the term Indian. The government ministry in charge is still called Indian Affairs. The Kanakas had an unusual position that I think of as somewhere between the whites and the Indians in terms of their status. They were dark-skinned people, and over time there were certainly lots of newcomers among the whites who discriminated against them personally in various ways. But legally, they were not discriminated against in Canada as they were in some of the Northwest states. For example, in Oregon, there were actual laws passed that denied them the right to get land, even though everybody else coming in there over the Oregon Trail was able to claim land for free. In Canada, they were able to acquire land and have the vote immediately and serve on juries and things like that. And actually, some of them ran and served in politics quite early along. But it's true that as more white settlers came in, both in the United States and in Canada, there were certainly examples of personal discrimination against them. However, in the very early years, they had this privileged status because they had been with the Hudson's Bay Company before any of these settlers. So they actually enjoyed a special relationship with the government of British Columbia and were actually given favorable treatment, which stood them in good stead.
Would you talk a bit about Hawaiians, maybe about the ethnicities of people who lived together at the forts and who worked for Hudson's Bay Company, and the female-male makeup.
Sure.
What I mean.
At the Hudson's Bay forts, so we're talking about before settlement, before people actually started moving off on their own and acquiring land, you had these outposts that were basically forts in the middle of Indian territory. And at these forts, the main population on the West Coast, the main workers were Hawaiians, were actually the largest single group. The officers were almost entirely British. And then there were other employees that had been brought over the mountains from eastern Canada. And these were mainly either Iroquois Indians, or they were what was called French Canadian voyageurs. These were Métis. These were part Indian, part French men who had lived in either Quebec, or in some cases they had lived at the Red River Colony in the prairies. And they were skilled fur traders. Some of them had second, third, fourth generations of fur traders. They had been working for the Northwest or Hudson's Bay companies, in some cases, for 100 years, their families. So they were brought over the mountains on these fur trading brigades. And all of these people lived together at these forts, or outside the forts in many cases, because the forts were small. The officers, some of them lived inside the fort, but generally the lower classes, the ordinary workers, lived outside the forts. And the Indians also tended to, local Indians who were trading with these forts, also tended to cluster around the forts. So sometimes you had Indian villages forming new ones, clusters of tents or small buildings going up right next to the forts to be there when needed to do jobs and to trade. Now, the most interesting of these fur trading communities was Fort Vancouver, by far the largest. In the 1840s, for a few years, Fort Vancouver was by far the largest colony or settlement anywhere on the northwest north of San Francisco. It was bigger even than the Russians, any town the Russians had in Alaska, like Sitka. It had a population of over 500 fur trade employees. Of those, about half were Hawaiians. They lived outside the fort in what was called the Kanaka Village, a fairly large clustering of houses that they had built themselves. The company did not build them houses. They were shacks, really. They paid them a ration, a food ration, and gave them some money, but these people went and built their own houses. And some of them had wives, and the wives were, in almost all cases, Indian native women. There were a couple of hundred outside of Fort Vancouver. There were a couple of hundred native women living with these fur trade employees, and then they had children. So there were another few hundred children. So overall, it was more than 1,000 people living outside the fort in this so-called Kanaka village. And then there was a small number of a dozen or so officers living basically inside the fort. It was a very polyglot community. They spoke different languages. There were pidgin languages that developed, such as there were the Indians had a pidgin language called Chinook, which was sort of a trading language on the West Coast. And over the years, some Hawaiian words worked their way into Chinook, and people communicated any way they could. Some of them, of course, learned English, but French was still being used also in the Hudson's Bay Company, because it had been there were a lot of French Canadians, so they also spoke French.
My other one has a little plastic thing you can hold. That's this is great. Thank you very much. Could you explain, could you say what Kanaka means and whether it has connotations, mm-hmm. whether it used to have connotations, mm-hmm. what it means today?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the word Kanaka simply means a person or a man in Hawaiian, although actually man is strictly speaking kane, but human being or person really would be the translation. Now, it has had negative connotations at certain times. People have called each other, you dumb Kanaka, or something like that. But actually, the Hawaiians themselves never used it in a negative way. They are, even today in Hawaii, they're proud to call themselves Kanaka. There's a number of book titles besides mine that use Kanaka in them. So it's not a derogatory term, strictly speaking. The Hawaiians were called Kanaka also officially in the censuses in places like British Columbia. So and they referred to themselves as Kanaka. So when they were asked, "What are you?" they would say, "I'm a Kanaka." And on the voting lists in places like Salt Spring Island, where I live, the old voting lists, there would be the people or the censuses, when they went and took censuses, there would be the name and it would say Kanaka as an identifier rather than British or whatever. Yeah.
And did any Hawaiians go back to Hawaii, and was that difficult? Mm-hmm. Why would they stay? Why would they go?
Okay. During the fur trade period, when the Hawaiians were being recruited for these forts on the northwest coast, they were on a contract basis. They were being hired for 3 years at a time, usually. And it was part of the deal that they could go back. The Hudson's Bay Company had ships going back and forth a couple of times a year. And the Hudson's Bay Company also actually had a recruitment agency in Honolulu. So they were recruiting 50 or 60 new Hawaiians usually every trip. And on this, at the same time when the ships went back, they were bringing furs to places like China, but they were stopping in Hawaii so they could drop off employees. And so it was a choice at the end of the three-year period when you're being paid off. You could go back or not. Now, during the three-year period, a lot of these men acquired wives, or common-law wives, if you will, but some of them were actually formally married. There were missionaries, priests at these forts, and you could have a church marriage, and a lot of them did. So you had these Hawaiians starting families, and those people generally did not go back. Their wives and children would probably not have fit into Hawaiian society at all. I never came across any reference to them going back with their families. So basically it was men who either didn't like the service or had not started a family who went back. And from the statistics that I could see, from the figures, I went through the Hudson's Bay Company records quite carefully, it looked as though at least a third did go back. A slightly larger number stayed, and then quite a few died in service. It was quite dangerous, and there were illnesses, and lots of young men didn't live to their middle years, working men in those days. So they simply died usually in accidents on the rivers and at the mills and things like that. But probably more stayed in the northwest coast than went back, but a lot went back.
I found it interesting, the movement from the movement north of Hudson's Bay Company, okay, from Fort Vancouver north to making other forts, right, a little higher up. Right. And I was thinking, you could talk about that generally, but I was also thinking there were a couple of people you specifically spoke about in your book. I don't know.
I looked it up. I did, because you mentioned it.
Because I mentioned it.
Yeah, I looked them up because I wasn't fresh in my mind.
Explaining, you know, right, sort of using them to explain sure how it moved up, sure, and that they were generally, whether they were typical or whether they were particularly successful or lucky.
Yeah. So the fur trading, the formal, the land-based fur trade at the fort started at the Columbia River, but it didn't remain at the Columbia because the Columbia was more or less the southern end of the rich fur trading area on the northwest coast. The coast, the areas farther north, especially what's today British Columbia, had lots of excellent potential for fur trading with the Indians. And so the Hudson's Bay Company eventually began to establish forts in what is now first in Washington State and then what is now British Columbia. The first and most important of those in the early years, in the 1820s and 30s, was Fort Langley. And this is at the mouth of the Fraser River, not too far from the city of Vancouver, British Columbia. And the first couple of Hawaiians who went to establish that fort were interesting guys. One was named Komo, and one was named Pio Pio. Komo had been at Fort Vancouver, and before that he had been with the Northwest Company. So he was one of the very early people who had come, probably around 1816, 1818 or so, and had worked at one of the forts, most likely Astoria, on the Columbia River before the big fort, Fort Vancouver on the Columbia, had even been built. And then they established Fort Langley, and he went with the first group north. He had been a cook in one of his guises on the fur trading, but I'm not sure that's the only thing he had done, but he was referred to by one of the officers as a cook. This is a young guy, of course. And then when he came up to Vancouver, to the Vancouver area, to Fort Langley, he was mainly employed at first as a sawing wood. Now, they didn't even have a real mill yet, like a water mill, but they were pit sawing. They were sawing by hand. And so in the records of Fort Langley, I came across these references to Como and Pio Pio sawing more logs today, and then it was Como and Pio Pio sawing again. And these were officers' records, and the Owyhees sawing, starting another saw pit. They sometimes called them Owyhees, starting with an O, O-W-H-Y, Owyhees. And after, I think it was about 14 or 15 years at Fort Langley, Como went back to Fort Vancouver. He had a wife by then, and I think he was able to bring her along, but then he died in his 50s. But he had been with the Hudson's Bay Company something over 30 years. Pio Pio was also...
get more enthusiastic, right. You get louder,
okay.
Something.
Oh, okay.
But Pio Pio is just real harsh. So
okay.
Go ahead.
Pio Pio, who went north with Como, helped to found Fort Langley, was also an interesting character. He had also joined when it was still the Northwest Company on the Columbia. So that was before 1820. And he became, he was one of the ones who became a specialist after this pit sawing episode. He became a cooper, which is a barrel maker. Now at Fort Langley, they were, among the other jobs that they were doing, was salting salmon. The Fraser River had tremendous runs of salmon, just like the Columbia. And it was a great place for them to trade for salmon from the Indians. So the Indians did most of the catching of the salmon. And at the fort, they would salt them down. And then they had to pack them into barrels. And they were selling them mainly to Hawaii. And even to this day, Hawaii, which has no salmon, Hawaiians love salted salmon. They call it lomi lomi salmon, and it's a very popular dish at any luau that you go to in Hawaii. You're likely to have lomi salmon. I've had it there myself. And anyway, so they had tremendous numbers of barrels had to be built. I think by the peak, they were selling something like 2,000 barrels of smoked salmon a year to Hawaii. And so somebody had to make these barrels, and these were the coopers. And so Pio Pio became a cooper. He was taught it by somebody else, obviously. Wouldn't have gone to a trade school. But he learned it, and so as typical, I could see this in the Hudson's Bay records, he was paid a bonus. The average worker was making, I think it was 17 pounds, these are British pounds, a year, which wasn't very much money, let's say $100 roughly. And Pio Pio was getting an extra £3 a year for being a cooper, not just being an ordinary laborer. He stayed at Fort Langley. He also had a wife, and he had, I think, 3 children. He never left the area. Eventually, he had a son named Joseph Mayo, who was apparently quite a physical specimen. The Indians supposedly called him the strongest man in the world, this son, Joseph Mayo. And Joseph Mayo, as a young guy growing up at the fort, of course, what else was there to do? He also worked for the company, and he got sent on one of these trading brigades up the Fraser River to the interior of British Columbia. It was called New Caledonia. It was a very rough place at that time, very difficult place to live. A very isolated fort, and he spent a couple of years in New Caledonia, and then he came back down, and then he went into the trade of being a cooper too. So he worked for many years as a cooper. And finally, whereas Como went back to Fort Vancouver on the Columbia, Pio Pio and his son Joseph Mayo never did. They settled on the Fraser River. Just as there had been a gold rush in California in 48, in 1858, there was a gold rush on the Fraser River, up the Fraser River, and gold miners came in by the thousands, and it sort of destroyed the fur trade. So at that point, land was thrown up open to settlement, and the fur trade really waned quite quickly in the 1860s. And people like Pio Pio and his son Joseph Mayo were able to claim land for themselves for free, 160 acres each, and they had already been living on the Fraser in their own houses and commuting, in a sense, across by boat to the fort to work there. And so basically they both retired from the company, and some of these Hawaiians continued to do odd jobs for the company, part-time work, but they settled and became farmers along the Fraser River, and they had adjacent holdings of 160 acres each and built houses. And the last I heard of in the records, the last reference I found to Joseph Mayo, the son of Pio Pio, was that he was still fishing on his own boat as an old man in, I think it was 1915. So he lived to a ripe old age.
Great. So a successful family. Yeah. What did Hawaiians think about working for Hudson's Bay Company and the other fur traders? Were they, I mean, I know you were talking about the whaling ships and they were extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. Were there those that said, no, we're not having any more of this, and they deserted, or were they pretty much happy with what they had, or at least contented with what they had? Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know what the Hawaiians actually thought of their service with the Hudson's Bay Company, because so few of them were literate that there are almost no actual letters or testimonies in their own words. There is one letter, I believe, written for one of the fur trade employees that got back to Hawaii and has been preserved, but it doesn't really deal with his service with the company. It's more just describing a luau that was being held on Puget Sound in the 1860s. So just proud that the Hawaiians there were still keeping up some of their heritage and some of their practices.
Could you say describing a luau? Could you start from there?
And okay. Puget Sound, just because I could hear the chair. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
He wrote a letter. He dictated a letter. Okay. You can just start.
Okay.
This was... I think it's cool.
Okay. One Hawaiian whose letter has been preserved, named Naukana, I believe was illiterate himself, but I think someone wrote the letter for him. He described a luau being held by Hawaiians on Puget Sound in the 1860s, and it was a letter, a very proud letter, saying essentially, we, the sons of Hawaii, held this wonderful luau, and we invited our white or American friends, they were very glad to come, and they were very honored to be there, and we ate our dishes, and then they came and they ate some of our dishes and some of their types of dishes, and we want you back in Hawaii to know that we are keeping up this honorable tradition. This was the essence of this letter home. But sadly, very few Hawaiians could read or write, of the Hawaiians who went into the fur trade, at least. And so we don't really know that much about what they thought of their service. I think the best testimony is simply that so many of them signed up again. They didn't have to. They could have gone home after 3 years, but actually most of them stayed longer than 3 years. Most did sign up again. Some of them eventually went home anyway. But then it might have been after 6 years or 9 years, whatever, they kept signing up. And it was certainly a good enough job that a lot of them kept it for the rest of their lives, or at least until the fur trade ended, because that's really what happened. In a sense, it petered out.
Yeah. So about when did that... Mm-hmm. So about when did this stop?
Right, okay. So basically, the fur trade waned with massive white settlement in on the Columbia, in the southern area. It petered out in the 1850s with white settlers coming over the Oregon Trail, and in British Columbia farther north it waned quickly in the early 1860s to the point where there were no new forts built, and the old forts gradually were abandoned. Eventually they were all abandoned. None of them exist today, except as historical sites.
Sorry, could you say none of them exist today except as historical
sites? Right. None of these old traditional forts exist today except as historical sites. Fort Langley and Fort Vancouver on the Columbia are both wonderful places to visit. They've been rebuilt as close to the original look as possible, and they have staff who dress in period costumes and demonstrate some of the trades, such as barrel making and blacksmith shop and this kind of thing. It's really worth going to see.
And kind of, I guess, going back to, maybe before we go there, do you know some Hawaiian place names?
On the Northwest Coast?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe if it's interesting, right, where they came from.
Right. There are lots of place names on the Northwest Coast that have Hawaiian references, although a lot of them are generic. They're things like Kanaka Creek, Kanaka Bar. These are on the rivers. They're the bars. There's a Kanaka Bar on the Fraser. I think there's an Owyhee River off the Snake River. I believe it's in either Idaho or in Oregon. It's a place where some Hawaiians drowned, and they named the river after them. But then there's a few towns, such as Kalama, Washington, which is named after a Hawaiian. One of the fur traders was named John Kalama. And there's an island up the British Columbia coast, Kamano Island, which is named after one of the Hawaiians there. So there are a number of places. On Salt Spring Island, where I live, there is a Kanaka Road, for example. So they're sprinkled around. There's a Kanaka Point on San Juan Island in the San Juans in Washington State. There's quite a few places with Kanaka names.
So going back sort of to what you found while you were doing your book, mm-hmm. What do descendants of Hawaiians, what do they think about this history? How do they
today?
Still
okay.
practice their Hawaiian heritage?
Right. The descendants of the original Kanakas that I've gotten to know over the years, and I know many of them, are amazingly proud of their unique background. They know all about it. They feel that it makes them a little different from their friends and associates here in Canada or in the United States. A lot of them have shown this by going back to Hawaii and tracing their roots. There's a lot of interest in Hawaiian genealogy. Hawaiians themselves traditionally were very interested in their own genealogy. They actually used to chant their genealogy as a way of introducing themselves to people. This was an old thing in Hawaii. But the other thing that they've done in recent years, and it's been a lot of fun for me to be involved in it, is that they have gotten together every few years, for a while it was really every summer, and had these kind of Hawaiian gatherings around the Vancouver area, and some of them are around Seattle. They call them the Hawaiian Connection or the Kanaka Connection and things like this. They were generally something between a luau and just a big party. One of them that I went to really was a wonderful luau right on the beach here in Salt Spring Island. That was a great occasion. But others, some of them were just parties in a park near Vancouver, for example. And they'd have music. There was a Hawaiian slack key guitar band that played at one of them. There was sometimes hula dancing. And often there was Hawaiian food, including the traditional food such as pig cooked on a spit. Another traditional Hawaiian way of cooking is to put seafood and fish and wrap it in seaweed and bury it in the beach over coals and cook it underground, all surrounded by tarps to keep it clean, for quite a few hours. And they've had that at some of these events, this kind of traditional seafood. There's a I forget the name of it, but there's a coconut dish that's common in Hawaii, kind of a dessert that was served at some of these events. So, and then people wear their aloha shirts, and they have they put their fingers up in this funny pattern of thumb and pinky, which means hang loose or right on, brother, kind of thing that Hawaiians do to each other and wave at each other in that way. So they get into it. They get down and they get into it.
And before, I'm going to ask you the canoe thing again at the very end.
Okay.
But what can, besides the history of this, is there anything more universal that we could learn from going back to this history? Mm-hmm. Or what should people take from it?
Okay.
What have you learned maybe first?
Right. Okay.
Because then it's you and then universal.
Okay. One of the things that has struck me in studying this Hawaiian history on the Northwest Coast is something that I don't think most people would think of at first, but that the early frontier years were actually a time of greater tolerance and cooperation with people than the later years. That the Hawaiians were actually, at least in British Columbia, where they were officially accepted by the government and allowed to claim land, were treated quite well and managed to get along quite well with their neighbors. Whereas in later years, there was definitely a sense of discrimination. I think it's really just who you were. If you proved yourself as a good worker or as a reliable neighbor or a cooperative neighbor on the frontier, you were accepted. And there was a lot of intermarriage, too, across the races during the frontier years. And later on, there was less. And I think it's the people who were coming in, the new settlers, they were not interested in intermarrying with dark-skinned people or whatever. They were the women, for one thing, were coming from on bride ships from Europe and places like that. That's not why they were coming to the Northwest Coast. But in the early years, there was a level of tolerance that I think was quite admirable.
And do you want to tell me about the Hawaiian canoe
racing? Okay, right, sure.
And how it's similar to the Indian canoe racing?
Sure. One of the most enjoyable experiences for me was just shortly after my book was published, these two large Hawaiian voyaging canoes came to the Northwest Coast. Now, these canoes, they were double-hulled canoes, they had sailed across the Pacific several times, but on this particular occasion they didn't have time. They shipped them on a freighter to Seattle, and then they had these joint events between the crew members and the local communities in Seattle and Vancouver, and then later on the two canoes went different directions. One went all the way up to Alaska, the other went all the way down to San Diego. But what was so interesting was that at many of these events were joint events between the canoe and the crews of the canoes and local Indian or First Nations bands in Canada.
Okay.
I might spoil it.
It's just an hour. It's supposed to be 2 hours.
See, can I start somewhere intermediate?
Geez.
Or start right from the beginning?
Didn't you say they mm-hmm. you'd already said they'd come.
Yeah.
So what they did was they met with Indian or native.
Okay, well, now wait a minute, I should back up. Okay.
Whatever you feel comfortable.
Okay. So these canoes came to Seattle and Vancouver and then split up, and one went north and one to Alaska and the other went south to San Diego. Along the way, they had joint events of various kinds with local Indian, or in Canada we call First Nations groups. And what was so interesting was that many of these First Nations groups in Canada, or Indian bands or tribes in Washington State, for example, were partly Hawaiian themselves. And they were aware of their Hawaiian heritage. So, for example, in Washington State, the Lummi of the Bellingham area have some Hawaiian blood, and they're quite aware of it. And some of those Lummi Indians have come to the Canadian events, these connection get-togethers. In Vancouver, there's a large family called Nahanis in North Vancouver, the Squamish band or Kapalano band there, who are part Hawaiian and are very aware of their heritage and always have been proud of it. And the most interesting thing was to see that they had a similar tradition in a way of canoeing and canoe racing. So in Hawaii, canoe racing is a big sport. It's outrigger canoes paddled by six paddlers. And there are these huge canoeing clubs that race all the time. They race along the shores of the islands. They race between islands. They do all of this kind of thing. Well, the Indians, especially in British Columbia, also do this. They don't have outrigger canoes. They have these large, very long dugout canoes with larger numbers of paddlers. And especially in places like near where I live on Vancouver Island, you see these canoes on trucks being taken from one place to another, and they're constantly racing. And again, it's a very serious sport. They take it really seriously. They're very proud of their canoe teams. It's important to win. And these are usually, you know, one Indian band versus another, or one club versus another. And so when these twin-hulled canoes came over from Hawaii, and they held a joint sort of potlatch and luau. A potlatch is the traditional Indian ceremony here, and the luau is the traditional Hawaiian one. So at the North Vancouver longhouse of the Squamish, they hosted this wonderful event that I was honored to be invited to, where they cooked the pigs and they had the seafood and all these things. But in addition, they had these joint paddling dances with the Hawaiian crews did their paddling dances, and then the local Indians did theirs. And it was just a wonderful thing to watch. They were getting their heritages sort of mixed up, but a good time was had by all. I should say there was no alcohol either at these events. They never serve alcohol at these potlatches. So.
Great. Is there anything else that you would like to add? If you don't think of anything, remember you still have to do your book plug.
My book plug. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. sure. I'll do that. Oh, the trials and tribulations of being an author. I've had a wonderful experience publishing my book, but strangely enough, even though it actually did quite well, the publisher eventually let it go out of print. And at first I was quite upset, but in a way it's turned out very good for me because people were still very interested in it. And so I actually have had the book reprinted on my own, and now I can sell it and make a better profit, and I often sign the books for people. So lots of people may look online and they'll look at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It looks as if the book is out of print. Well, they can still get it from me, and it's through my website, my email address, koppel@saltspring.com, and I will personally sell them a copy and sign it for them. I've mentioned the connection between the Hawaiians and the native Indians here in British Columbia, but one of the most interesting things is how the families of the Hawaiians ended up becoming either white, joining the mainstream society, or becoming Indian. It depended on the sex or gender of the second generation in almost all cases, because you had the Hawaiian young men marrying Indian women, and if their child was a son in the frontier, there were no other Hawaiian women generally to marry. There were almost no white women who would have them as wives, so they would almost all marry native Indian women, just as the other fur traders were by and large doing. Even the whites were doing that. Even the officers of the company were doing that. And then settlement began, and the countries became states, or they became Canada and the provinces, and the organized Indian reserves arose. And so these second generation young men and their Indian wives would end up being Indian, and their subsequent children and later generations would be Indian. They'd be part of these Indian reserves. But if they were girls, if the child of that first generation was a girl, she would very likely end up meeting a white guy, because they were certainly around. They were moving in as settlers, as miners, and things like that. And there were very few white women for them to marry. So they were, by and large, taking either Indian wives or, in these cases, part Hawaiian, part Indian wives. And their later children would usually become part of the mainstream society. And four generations later, they're white. And some of them were not even aware of their Hawaiian background for a while, till it was sometimes kept a secret in their family.
That's great. Anything else that's come to mind?
Well, that's Larry Bell is the example
that
of that.
Yeah.
I mean, Larry Bell's considered, well, he now, I don't know what he considers himself now. He may consider himself some interesting mix, but he would have grown up in a mainly white circumstance, or there was this, the finance minister of, this is one of Jean Barman's discoveries, the finance minister of BC, a guy named Mel Cuvelier, was totally unaware that he was part Hawaiian. He thought he was part Indian, but until he was thinking of running for premier of the province, which is like governor, and at that point he thought he'd better find out the exact truth about his background, and he asked Jean Barman to look into it, and she's the one who told him that he was part Hawaiian. She checked into his family.
So was the Hawaiian-ness encouraged in families?
Eventually, I think it was discouraged among the whites. I think that's the thing. In the early days, it was more tolerant, but eventually, even being part Indian was something that you didn't talk about. Nowadays, it's trendy again, perhaps. But in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, people did not talk about being part Indian or part Hawaiian. They may have suspected that they had some mixed blood of some kind, that they weren't blonde-haired and blue-eyed or something like that, but they didn't talk about it. It wasn't a social advantage to go saying that you're part Hawaiian or part Indian. So families, in some cases, in British Columbia, in Washington State, didn't tell their children. They kept quiet. Ask Larry Bell.